Life,
a podcast of the cinema,
starring Alonzo Duralde. That's not me. That's
no, it's
you.
Me.
And also me. My name is Dave White.
You are Dave
film
White.
Critics.
We are
for the Wrap. Mm-hmm. You're the film reviews editor of the Wrap.
True.
Well. You do other podcasts that are not this one. You might talk about them later. Maybe
we will.
And
we have a guest today.
We have a guest today, and we have the urgent need to clip on through this episode so that you can deliver our old television to the
West Hollywood Electronics Recycling. It's a very exciting day.
And so that
also
I can
the
go
Academy
to
Awards.
Kaiser Urgent Care, because my head is about to sever itself from my body.
Poor Dave.
That's what's happening.
He's having eye issues. It's not pleasant for him.
My eye is swelling up to the size of a football. And I just want everyone to understand what a trooper I am.
Yes.
We're continuing to work on my Sunday doing this podcast.
I don't care if you have to cut and cry. You cut and cry.
I'm not going to watch the Academy Awards. I'm going to be sitting in the waiting room of Kaiser Urgent Care, because we have a friend who is a biology person. That's his degree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what the hell he does.
He has a degree in biology person.
And I took a picture of my eye and sent it to the group chat just to amuse everyone. And he said, that could be a staph infection. Go to urgent care right now. And I was like, all right, fine.
Well, anyway, our guest, we haven't allowed to speak yet because we're being totally rude.
We're not being rude. We're just setting the stage of friendship.
Okay, fine.
It's in the title
of the show. They know who it is. Johnny Jungle Guts, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Co-host of the Super Gay Podcast.
I'm back to talk about the genre that I love.
Yes.
All Margot Robbie films.
I know more about comics than Dave White does, but you know far more about comics than I do, so that brings a lot to the conversation.
You've got a lot of
for better or worse
information.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm not keeping up
with
the
current things. You're an old-timey person, and therefore you have old-school information.
Like, for me, Birds of Prey is the 90s, what, Gail Simone run?
That's right.
Oracle. Like, that was my idea of this, but this
Johnny
is something
young
different.
And fresh. He knows new things.
That's right.
some new things,
he's
yes.
of the now people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, we're talking about four movies.
Yeah, it's a very genre-y week. I guess nobody wanted to open a like Serioso movie opposite the Oscars.
No. So we've got Birds of Prey we're going to talk about. We're going to catch up on talking about Gretel and Hansel.
Yes.
That we didn't cover last week.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about The Lodge
and
Come to Daddy.
Yes.
Which is a film in theaters.
It is.
And not on Pornhub.
But also, that's a different one, I'm sure. Come to Daddy is in theaters, but also streaming.
Yes.
But so, not on Pornhub.
But let's, I guess next episode we'll recap any Academy Award stuff that we need to talk about.
Well, since it hasn't happened yet, that seems
quite
like a good idea.
I know, but in the years past, I'm thinking about how
we've done a quickie like Monday morning thing.
We did a quickie Monday morning thing.
Yeah, that's what
happened. Maybe we could do that tomorrow. I don't know.
Maybe, if we're feeling it.
We're so not enthusiastic about the Academy Awards this year that we haven't even seen all the nominated films.
No.
Film critics, it's our job.
Yeah.
Who have seen these things, but I haven't seen Ford v. Ferrari.
Me neither.
I haven't seen Two Popes. I still haven't seen, who knows what else I haven't seen. Harriet. I didn't see Harriet.
I didn't see I Lost My Body or The Edge of Democracy.
I saw The Edge of Democracy. And I saw American Factory.
Yes, and Honeyland. We talked about those
couple of weeks ago. But like, there's just so many things.
I haven't seen Corpus Christi.
Is that nominated for something?
The Polish Best Foreign Film contender.
Oh, is it? It's nominated?
Yes.
I wondered what that was. It's been sitting on our stack of screeners.
Yeah, that's why I hung on to it, because it's an Oscar nominee. I thought, surely I'll get to this.
Well, you didn't get
to it. I don't care about the Academy Awards, so it just was hard for me to like carve out time in my schedule to watch these films that I was not super enthusiastic about, even if they are embossed
with
the... I
guess what also is a bummer for me is that...
I did see Harriet.
I'm not going to get to see my favorite part of the Oscars, which is the red carpet.
Mm. which our friend Louis Vertel will be covering on Twitter. I believe it's at the Academy is where that's happening.
Oh, really?
But if you go to at Louis Vertel, I'm sure he'll point you to the right direction.
Who does the red carpet now that Joan Rivers is dead? No, who cares?
I'm sure E has somebody like Juliana Rancic, or I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. I know that
Ross Matthews,
maybe.
Perhaps. I don't know.
ABC has it on lockdown for like the last hour.
Uh-huh.
And that's like
before the show starts.
Is that?
And that's when the fancy people finally show up.
Right. Right. But I don't know who hosts the ABC.
Probably ever. Like Chris Connolly. Doesn't he always pop out for these kind of show busy things?
I don't know.
Ryan Seacrest is who I'm imagining does it.
I'm sure he's doing it for somebody.
I want Kathy Griffin on the red carpet. That's who I want on the red carpet.
Yeah, that's not happening.
I want her in more places.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anyway. Intimidating Renee Zellweger.
Oh, I think they made up.
Well, yeah, but I think there's always an unspoken undercurrent between those two.
I thought they made up.
Maybe they did. I hope so. Peace in 2020, everybody.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't hate, appreciate.
You know what else is great today?
What's that?
Shaws of Sunset comes back.
Ooh.
I've got that set right up at the DVR. If I come back from urgent care, I'm totally watching Shaws of Sunset tonight.
You will. You will live to see.
You don't know.
Reza another day.
I could.
Your TV friends.
I could collapse in the street. Who would help me? No one. No one, maybe.
Not on Oscar Day.
Listen, not on Academy Awards Day. People are busy. Okay.
Before we dive into this, I want to point out real quick, since we don't have a sponsor this week, Linoleum Knife has a Patreon page, and Super Gay has a Patreon page. Support the podcast you love. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife or Patreon and or patreon.com/supergays
with a Z.
Thank you. But was Super Gay taken?
I think so.
I hate that. That's like somebody has the at Linoleum Knife Twitter account and never used it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some of that going on with Super Gay as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A rump.
Awful people. All right. The first film that we need to talk about is Birds of Prey.
Yes.
And I'm going to let y'all lead the discussion.
Okay.
Because I have opinions about this film. I saw it yesterday. At the Cinerama Dome.
Really?
That's where it was happening.
Oh, God, you hate the Dome.
I don't hate the Dome. I love that it exists. I love the architecture.
Sure. You love it from the outside.
The seats are not... Look. I'll say the same thing I say about them that I say about Alamo Drafthouse. I'm too fat for your seats. Don't like them. I'm too fat. Your seats are fat-phobic.
Well,
and I deserve better.
In the case of the Dome, they have the excuse of having been built in the 60s.
They could renovate.
I think they could. They should.
They could renovate those seats.
Sure. Could. No argument here.
Yep.
Okay, so Birds of Prey, or The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, which is the full title of the film.
That's my first problem, by the way. But let's. Yeah.
Okay, so we open on... Harley Quinn breaking up with the Joker, and this is a problem because A, she still is obsessed with him, and B, people in the Gotham underworld who were previously inclined to give her a pass and not come after her now figure they can attack her anytime they want to because she no longer has the protection of the legendary, psychotic criminal. There's a MacGuffin. There's a diamond that everybody wants because there's a bunch of bank accounts in the middle of it. And the main guy who seems to want it is Ewan McGregor as Black Mask. One of his flunkies and an entertainer in his nightclub is Dinah Lance, a.k.a. the Black Canary, who we find out that her mother used to help out Gotham PD. But
they're alluding to this idea that her mother was a superhero.
I guess they don't come out and say it, but they're definitely, she was on the side of the law for sure. We meet Renee Montoya from Gotham City Police Department, a detective who has been in a very 9-to-5 way. Like, you know, the guy that she worked with got the credit for all of her good work and got the promotion, and she's still, you know, slugging it out behind a badge. There is the Huntress, whose family once owned the diamond in the first place, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Oh, by the way, Journey Smollett-Bell is Black Canary, and Rosie Perez is Renee Montoya. Mary Elizabeth Winstead plays the Huntress, who is a daughter of a mafia family. The sole survivor of the massacre of that family was raised by assassins in Italy and has now returned to Gotham City to clear the ledgers, as it were. And then there is a young girl named Cassandra Cain, who is in no way like the one in the comics. She's a very skillful pickpocket. She steals the diamond in question and thus begins this entire mad rondelay.
Yeah.
This is a movie that jumps back and forth in time a lot. And I'm like, you know what? I do not want to hear your complaints about Little Women if you can follow this movie. Because, you know, I had no problem figuring out who was where and when and why. But anyway, so, you know, these five women from different sides of the law are eventually sort of brought together and have to fend off Black Mask and his goons, led by the notorious hitman Victor Zsasz, played by Chris Messina in a platinum do.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him at first.
Yeah, and
he looks not like Mark Ruffalo this time.
It very much not. Yes.
What? Who else is this guy? What does he do? What other movies?
Chris Messina. He was in A Way We Go. He was in
Mindy Project.
Yeah. Like, you've seen him and stuff.
Oh, he's that guy. Wow. Yeah. All right, yeah.
He's a that guy. So this is the first big studio movie from director Kathy Yan. She previously did an indie comedy called Dead Pigs. It is written by Christina Hodson, whose background is... Oh, she wrote the Bumblebee movie, which we liked.
Right.
And she wrote Unforgettable, Dave.
Really?
Yes.
Well...
With Rosario Dawson and Katherine Heigl.
Katherine Heigl, vaping.
Exactly.
Vaping for the ages. That film.
So, yeah, this movie is, you know, here's my take on Birds of Prey is that it's the movie that delivers on what the Suicide Squad trailers promised.
Sure.
Because if you remember, when Suicide Squad was being made, like, they cut this trailer that was very sort of wacky and colorful, and it played really well with people, to the extent that they actually went back to the movie itself and changed it to be more like the trailer, which was one of the many problems with Suicide Squad. But I felt like this is a movie that is delivering on that level of, like, cartoony, you know, violent mayhem.
Well, what's interesting is that I think if you look in sort of the Batman handbook, the biggest source of inspiration here visually would actually be the Schumacher films.
Kind of, yeah.
It's like a dirtier, grittier, and I mean that by like a more lived-in world than those Schumacher movies, but it has that same color to it. What's funny also is that there's many moments where me... being in Los Angeles, I noticed that it was shot in L.A.
Yes, yeah. Me too.
I recognized especially a lot of the locations in Chinatown, and it's funny because Gotham is typically so associated with New York. Yeah. But
right.
I think that they were sort of focusing on what's called the East End of Gotham City, and also there was a lot of shots in what would technically be considered the East Side of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Well, what I always like about, you know, having grown up on the 1966 TV show and on the sort of like Comics Code era comics, I love a Gotham City that has like a chemical plants and abandoned amusement parks and fog shrouded piers and just thrown in somewhere, you know.
And they utilize it really. Okay. There's some things I didn't like about this movie. The thing about Harley Quinn is, she's kind of like this character where I always... The best way I can describe it is I went to community college in New Jersey when Hot Topic was at the height of its power.
How many times have we spent in the past 24 hours invoking the name
Hot Topic?
Yeah. Right. And this, I just remember, like, some of the, I remember this girl in my, because I failed out of freshman physics, and so I had to take biology and chemistry at community college that summer. And I remember there was this girl in my class who really grinded on my nerves, but she could drive, and I remember her taking me to Burger King to get lunch, and I was like, after a, like a little while, I was like, she was still getting on my nerves, but it was kind of endearing almost to me. And that's sort of the way I feel about Harley Quinn. Like, a lot of things about this script annoyed me, but like, I sort of ended the movie like kind of trying to like hold back like a smile. Like, I was like, I was happy for her, you know what I mean? And what was really great in this movie was that they took all that great 60s, you know, amusement park, abandoned pier stuff, and utilized it for these really incredible, like, stunt work.
Action pieces, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the comedy and some of the script didn't land for me, there was this sort of subtle comedy to a lot of the, to the choreography, actually.
Yeah, the funhouse fight at the end is so aggressively psychedelic that I was like, ooh. This is like Modesty Blaze all right. of a sudden.
There's also a distinct 60s Batman TV show Biff Bang Pow quality to the fighting at the end, where it's violent, but not because it's so clearly like
choreographed,
set up that way, and the, you know, the impact feels comic, and you're not getting, you know, monster violence, sure. You know, here. You're not getting, like, R-rated spray of blood, you know, kind of thing. You're getting comic book fighting.
Yeah.
Which I did enjoy.
And, you know, I think what I liked about how this movie presents Harley is that so much of the character is so often just about her obsession with the Joker. Like, she's sort of the ultimate groupie in a way. And so this movie, I felt like kind of allowed her to be her own person. And it didn't do the stupid thing that Suicide Squad did, where it pretended that her deepest, fondest wish was to be like a suburban housewife. But at the same time, it defined her personality completely independently of the Joker, allowed her to be her own kind of driving force of madness. And so I liked the pivot constantly between this sort of like boop boop a doop, you know, kind of like breathy girly talk to like suddenly, oh wait, you do have a PhD in psychology and you are very good at reading people very quickly in terms of what is driving them. So I don't know. I and you know, obviously Margot Robbie is doing a lot of the work to make that, you know, come off, but I don't know. I was never not entertained. I just had kind of a dumb grin on my face for the whole thing. It's not a deep movie. It's not an important movie, but like, you know, it is the movie that they clearly wanted it to be, I felt like. I think so often with superhero movies especially, you get the gap between how you're experiencing it and what they want you to feel or experience or you know, respond to. And I felt like this one, everything was paying off, even if it was paying off in a goofy way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that for fans of the comics, whenever Harley gets her own series, it is similar to what this film was doing in that it always sort of starts with her breaking up with the Joker and then figuring out how to move away from that. Gail Simone, who wrote the original Birds of Prey comic, was a consultant on this movie, and she did say that like Margot Robbie was learning, like, almost masterfully all these different, like, sword fighting, gymnastics, like, in a couple weeks. Like, they were, like, the stunt people were really just shocked by that whole thing, so.
Now, okay, I was saying before that I kind of know the Oracle version of Birds of Prey. Have there been more recent iterations of the comic book that are more along the lines of what we're getting here, or?
I mean, I think what's happening here is DC's not really playing with a full deck of cards, because of, like, the weird way DC chooses to handle continuity across its various film and television properties.
Sure.
Like, I feel like maybe they haven't really figured out what's going on with Batgirl yet, because that movie's in development hell, I think. Mm-hmm. Poison Ivy. Maybe they wanted to use her in the Batman movie, so she's not popping up in this. So I think that's why we got the Birds of Prey team that we got here, which wasn't bad, but it's just sad to me that DC never really figured out how to handle like a universe across television and film the way Marvel did.
I don't know. I kind of like as somebody who grew up reading comics in the pre-Crisis era, sure, like I'm okay with the notion of like parallel Earths, you know? So like the Suicide Squad movies are not taking place in the same, it's not necessarily the same Batman of the Dark Knight movies, you know, or the Flash in the Justice League movie is not the same as the Flash on TV. Like, I think there are different, you know, and you know, even when you think about like, what was the one that came out in the 90s? Something like, it was called DC Universe or something, but it was basically like clearly aimed at younger readers.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and it would be the same heroes and they would have the same general backstory, but obviously nothing that happened in this comic book was canonical in the comics at large. I don't have any sense of needing it all to tie in together. I don't care if Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is picking up on something that just happened in The Winter Soldier or whatever. Like, that's fine if you want to do it that way, but I'm totally okay with the CW being over here and this movie and you know, the where does Todd Phillips Joker fit into any of this? Sure. Or does it? You know, like, I'm whatever.
And I totally agree with you. I would say that where I get annoyed is where they then will have a situation where they'll say, oh, you can't use this character for this movie that you want to use because use her for this other movie. And that's when it gets kind of like, and this has happened for a really long time. Like, I remember the Justice League cartoon couldn't use Aquaman because the CW was going to do an Aquaman TV show that flopped. And so they spent two seasons producing this Justice League cartoon without Aquaman for virtually no reason. Just stuff like that is just like, who cares?
No, that's exasperating. Like, if you have your paint box, like, you should just be able to dig into it and do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I would now like to complain.
All right, do it.
I was not bored. Because it's not a boring film. But there are some times when I'm watching, honestly, any of the comic book based films, that I just feel, as I'm watching, I feel disconnected. And I feel sort of just numbed by it all, just the omnipresence of it all, and I don't feel like I get a long enough break between the films. So when another one comes along, I'm like, okay, sure, I'm ready for this. This one did not bore me. It did not make me feel numb. But I don't know what it is about the word fantabulous that gets under my skin, but boy, does it get under my skin.
I think it's a great word.
I think it's, I think if you had called this film that name 20 years ago, sure, maybe. But I do believe sometimes that we've gotten to the point where self-conscious wackiness feels more and more self-conscious. And that's a lot of what I got from this.
Was it from Fantabulous or from One?
I'm sorry?
One Harley Quinn.
Oh, that's another... Listen, I'm just focusing on Fantabulous.
Fine.
But that subtitle there is indicative of how she speaks in the film. She's very verbal, and she and she over tells you stuff.
That was exactly what I was going to say. That was my biggest problem. Explains
things, and that is just the nature of this character, as you know, as created by Margot Robbie in these films. I don't know what she's like in the comic books, so that's okay with me, but it's not my favorite thing. It has an 80s feel to it that I thought maybe, you know, comedically we had left behind in the 80s. You know, that sort of overstatement to draw attention to the
absurdity.
The absurdity of stuff. So there's that. Sometimes I also feel like in the world of this and Deadpool and Suicide Squad,
mm-hmm.
there's a level of irreverence that would have felt fresh and nervy to me
mm-hmm.
when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
That I no longer am, you know,
dazzled by,
pushed by in any way. Sure. I don't, dazzled is the right word. And I think that this film and Suicide Squad and Deadpool all are a little more impressed with their own, you know,
cheekiness.
We're bad boys. We're cheeky. we're a naughty girl. We are irreverent
mm-hmm.
in a way that I think appeals to 13-year-olds. But I'm not especially interested in it. It doesn't, like, I feel like, do you see how wild I'm being and how bad I'm being? I'm so bad. Well, okay, yeah, sure, you are, I guess. I mean, you are like a, you're going to sell a child. So, yeah, technically, officially, you're bad. But doing it with that big of a wink,
see,
is not something that moves me anymore. And so I sat through to the end, sat through to the post-credits moment where she does it just one more time. And I just thought, all right, it's not for me.
Right.
But here's what I like.
Okay.
I like the action. I like the production design, how just sort of wildly colorful it was. I like that they, you know, press home the point, you know, where she sits on the couch and eats a box of Fruit Loops while watching a Tweety cartoon. Like, I understand what's happening.
Sure.
And I loved Mary Elizabeth Winstead pushing her own identity forward when no one else is taking her seriously.
Right.
They're calling her the wrong name. She's like, no, that's not my name. My name is this. And watch me do it, because I'm going to do it to you right now.
Right.
And you'll be sorry that you didn't take me seriously. I'm super into Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character.
I also like her.
She's the Huntress.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I liked her social awkwardness.
Yeah.
Because I never really seen explored in one of these movies that, like, if you were raised by assassins and done nothing but taught to be how to be an assassin, you might not be the smoothest customer when it comes to making new friends, you know,
yeah.
or engaging in conversation. So I like how she plays that. I get what you're saying about Deadpool and Harley sort of being kind of patting themselves on the back for being so, you know, like, irreverent. But I think of Bugs Bunny, you know, like I think
right.
of Bugs Bunny saying, ain't I a stinker, you know?
Right.
And so, like, I think there's an element of that that is, if you don't overkill it, I'm all right with it. And I think they don't overkill it, but that's my personal take. You know, so like there are two separate scenes where she is watching Looney Tunes cartoons.
Yeah.
And then there is a moment like about 2/3 of the way in the movie where she looks right at the camera.
She does.
In a very Bugs Bunny kind of way.
She
like,
does.
Okay,
and I enjoyed that
this
moment.
Is what we're doing here.
You know? So I had, you know, there's stuff about it that I liked.
Sure.
But stuff about it also just annoys me.
Can we talk about the sexiest moment of this movie?
Yes, please.
It involves a fried egg sandwich.
Oh.
Margie needs to write about this.
The making
for one of her food venues.
The making of the bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
Is, I think part of it is meant to turn you off. Like, I think part of you is meant to look at it and go, ooh, greasy, grody, big hairy forearm man making it. And the...
I thought it was a drooling close-up.
It is a gnarly cooking scene that is also
gorgeous.
It set every nerve ending I had on fire. Because I wanted one from that moment through to the end of the film.
When she talks about how, like, the American...
I want one right now.
The American cheese needs to be just a little old to melt in just the right way. And I was like, oh, give it to me now. But, you know, I think, you know, there is something to be said about the fact that this is a film written and directed by women. There was a great thread on Twitter that I just retweeted where a woman talks about how this is a movie about women dealing with trauma in different ways.
Yes.
But never in a way that feels exploitative. There's a scene where in Ewan McGregor's nightclub, he kind of humiliates this woman.
Yeah.
And I think whereas a male director would have just like held the camera on her, right. We would have relished every moment of her humiliation as a way of telling us how bad Ewan McGregor is. Yan cuts away to like Black Canary reacting to what's happening. So we still feel the tension and the awfulness of that moment without being party to it.
That's another good thing about this.
Yeah.
For sure.
So like there aren't a lot of moments where you think, oh, a woman directed this. But like I think that's definitely an example of the female gaze. And I think, yeah, you're right. The embrace of the Schumacher kind of color scheme, I think a lot of men directors would be still afraid to do just because of, you know, it's so queer and it was so unsuccessful.
Yeah.
Right. And unfortunately, you know, for all of my half in, half out, you know, opinion about this, this isn't doing very well.
No. And it's so frustrating. It's the tagline, go woke or go broke.
When people say that, it makes me homicidal.
It's not or. They say go woke and go broke.
That's what it is. Okay. Yeah. But it's just so frustrating because it's like, think about what you're saying. Like, when has money meant anything good? Like, why do we care about... Why are we prioritizing money? It's just such a bootlicking...
The a-holes online who say this stuff, it's like... They've always got an answer. If a movie does really well, it's because it pandered to the blah, blah, blah. It's not really being true to the comics fans.
Right.
Then if it flops, well, see, that's what you get for... It's like, okay, fine. Shut up. This bums me out because, like, not long ago, we had the Charlie's Angels movie, which I thought was great. And also
Charlie's Angels is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I don't understand why, like, more straight guys don't want to see alluringly clad women beat the crap out of a bunch of dudes.
Well, what's shocking about this is a lot of men online were making the argument that these women were not alluringly clad in this film.
Which is ridiculous.
Which is pretty crazy. Yeah. They're pretty sexy.
I don't know what that world wants.
Yeah, I think that we're coming from I think we're seeing glamour also in a way that maybe those guys don't care about.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. Mm. As queer viewers, all three of us, we see glamour where a lot of straight men would...
They just want more leg.
...see something completely different. Or it would leave them utterly cold.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
What was the singer you were talking about recently who is, like, so glamorous that men just are...
Ariana Grande.
Oh, that was it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Someone described her on the internet as high femme. And I thought, oh, yeah. That's why you've got someone like Green Day, dumbass. What's his name?
Billy Joe.
In general, he's not a dummy. But, like, this particular thing this past week, where he was talking about Billie Eilish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's very pro Billie Eilish. And he negatively compared Ariana Grande to Billie Eilish. And I'm like, well, first of all, Billie Eilish is, you know, an orange, and Ariana Grande is a glitter-covered apple. And so that's not, you can't even, they're not the same thing. But what you get in a moment when Billie Eilish and Ariana Grande are in the same room together is the two of them appreciating each other, which is what happened just recently at the Grammys. There's footage of this happening. And so, but yeah, you get a woman like Ariana Grande who inspires young women and queer audiences of, you know, all genders.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe hetero men don't quite dig her. Yeah. not just because of how she looks, but because of her whole everything. Like, her music is not what a lot of straight guys are thinking they want to listen to either.
So there's a
dividing line sometimes in aesthetics where, you know, queer people and non-queer women will look at something and go, yes. And straight dudes. A simple favor.
Perfect example.
A simple favor. Same deal. You know, how many gay dudes went out and saw that movie and they were like, yes. And
straight guys missed the point entirely.
Yeah. And so again, not all straight guys.
No hashtag. Yeah. We love Green Day
We love you straight guys.
Green Day did do something else stupid this week.
What else did they do stupid this week?
This billboard?
Oh, I saw that billboard too, and I was like, what are you doing?
It says, no features, no Swedish songwriters, no trap beats, 100% pure uncut rock. It's like, that's like the commercial you used to hear for the easy listening stations.
Yeah.
Without all that metal and rap.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like I remember there was a flyer.
That's a white people dog whistle right there.
It's always kind of racially charged, because I remember there was a flyer for a party when I was in college that said, no disco, no dubstep. And I was just like,
then why would I go?
Yeah.
Right. I would like a little bit of both of those things.
Anyway, so yeah, it would have been nice if this became a continuing thing, but I guess this is all we're getting now because this movie didn't do well.
You would know better than me how all that stuff works. Who knows?
But I think that the DC movies are on an interesting trajectory of late. Like, they figured out, I think they're getting closer to figuring out a voice of their own that isn't like, it's not exactly like the Marvel movies, but it's not as trying so hard to be the opposite of Marvel movies either. Like, they've gotten rid of the Zack Snyder kind of like bleak.
Yeah.
And so now you have like Wonder Woman and Aquaman and Shazam and this movie, and they aren't identical to each other, but they all have a certain sense of fun to them and a certain fun color palette. Again, not an identical one in movie after movie, but they feel more confident somehow than like BVS and Man of Steel, which felt like they were just trying so hard to like get themselves into this black smoky corner, you know.
Yeah, it's odd that DC was doing that in film, because really historically DC is the more absurd and colorful one.
True.
In the comics, but
yeah.
I mean, I felt the same way, kind of as Dave did, but I think I'm annoyed, but I'm charmed. And I love the stunts. I thought there was like subtle humor almost to the stunts. Like, there's one part where Harley's fighting a bunch of people in a car, and every once in a while she comes back to hit the same guy into the steering wheel.
Yes.
That was really funny.
Yeah. He's like the you know, the hi-hat or something. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Punctuating. So, also directed by women, and opening this week, is The Lodge, which is directed by the two women who directed the well-received horror film Goodnight Mommy, which I have not seen yet.
I like it a lot.
Okay. And everybody says it's much better than The Lodge, and I'm inclined to agree with
it. Certainly, totally is much better than The Lodge.
Dave, you want to describe this one?
Okay. So, this is not a spoiler, because it happens within the first 5 minutes. Alicia Silverstone plays a mother of two young children whose husband, played by
Richard Armitage,
has left her and is very soon going to marry another woman, played by Riley Keough. Upon hearing this news, Alicia Silverstone puts a gun in her mouth and blows her head off. And it is a practical special effect achievement, but not something that I was expecting, nor is it something that I was all that excited to see happen on screen.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like it's an uninterrupted shot. where, like, you know, she's busying herself with different tasks and da-da-da, and then she just reaches into the bag, grabs it, and it's all, all in one uninterrupted
shot. It's meant to jolt you into a different state of understanding about what's about to happen in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that. And it felt cheap.
It does.
And it felt exploitive, and it felt gross.
Yeah.
And I was on edge from the rest of the film, wondering what was coming next. And what else would be?
What they're going to do?
What else would be here that I could hate?
Yeah.
So here's what happens, and I won't spoil anything else. The kids have to go, obviously, live with the father, who is a terrible father.
Yes,
really
and,
bad.
And he's not the kind of terrible father that the movie, like, shows you being terrible. He's just
oblivious.
He's just oblivious. And the film never interrogates his obliviousness. It never asks you why this guy is being the way he is.
Mm-hmm.
He just, the film just allows him to be this way for the sake of what it wants to do next.
Right.
And what it wants to do next is introduce the character of Riley Keough to you. And all four of them now, the husband, the father, the young girlfriend, and the two kids,
mm-hmm.
go off to a very, very remote, gorgeous house in the middle of nowhere to spend Christmas there. The kids don't want to be there. Riley Keough is you know, hesitant. She doesn't know if it's good for her to be there with them as well, but here they all go. Within 24 hours... of being there, the father says, "I have to go back to town to do some work. you three will be fine here for the next 3 days, and I'll be back for Christmas." And that's when we learn that Riley Keough, as a child, was part of a religious cult who themselves all committed suicide in a very
ritualized
way, like the Heaven's Gate.
Yeah.
Like, and the People's Temple.
And her father ran the cult.
And her father ran the cult. And she was the only survivor. And this happened when she was 12. And that begins to influence what happens in the lodge.
This movie expects us
to go off if you wish.
Yeah, I mean, just this movie expects us to just sort of take it for granted, or to understand somehow that this father is so completely uncaring about his children's feelings that not only is he going to continue his relationship with the woman over whom his first wife, their mother, committed suicide, but that he's still planning on them getting married and quickly, like in a matter of months, you know. So it's just like, kind of like, what are
we... I think he says September, so it's...
It was originally September, and then he pushes it back, I guess, because...
Oh, okay, maybe I didn't have time.
Yeah.
By the way, may I interrupt a little bit? The directors, one of the directors is a woman, the other one is a man.
Oh, okay.
They are the team behind Goodnight Mommy. It's...
Oh, gotcha. Okay, sorry, I thought they were both
women. Anyway, go on.
Anyway, you know, so already you're like, well, the premise already seems just kind of shaky and like everyone's terrible. And then, you know, the movie, it's like on the one hand trying to sort of leave us wondering, like, is Riley Keough the menace? Are the kids the menace? Is something else in the house the menace? But there aren't enough choices, and so you figure it out before the movie decides it's going to tell you, so that makes it kind of not interesting. And then it exploits this notion of, like, Riley Keough is this mentally fragile woman who is a trauma survivor.
Yep.
But we're going to take her meds away and let's see what happens.
Right.
So well, like, what?
Right.
Well, I mean, there's a scene in the film where it's very obvious that she's not being honest with her fiance about the drugs she's on.
Yeah.
And
we don't know what this medication is.
They don't tell you what's going on, but spoiler alert for me, I myself am on some antipsychotic medication right now as I'm speaking to you. And I got so annoyed by her in that moment because, I mean, I would understand why other people would want to have sympathy, but when you're dating someone and you have a lot of stuff like that going on, it is only to your benefit once things get serious to tell them, because right. otherwise yeah. you feel like you're setting a trap for this person.
Right.
And he like had investigated the cult, and like that's how they met, right?
Was when that was the other things. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that he's awful, right? I mean, maybe the movie isn't showing us that in like extreme terms, but it's pretty clear to me that he's an idiot,
right?
And so anyway, so I was just like so annoyed by that relationship dynamic, and then it was just one of those movies that made me really wonder, like, what is the function of horror film? Because I have gotten more into watching horror lately, but most of the horror movies I've been watching are like old John Carpenter movies, or like there's a part in the movie where they're watching The Thing.
Yes.
And I was like, that was almost like comfort food for me. I was like, oh, like this is taking me to like something that I don't like, because there's a lot of horrible things that happen in this movie right away that are really relatable, you know?
Let's watch The Thing with young children while trapped in a
snowy
house.
Yeah, that didn't make any sense. But it was just one of those things where, you know, I mean, I do think it's true that sometimes movies these days are really trying a little too hard to have, like, a moral lesson to them. And I like the idea of film not having that as a requirement. But with this movie, I felt like there was just too much heavy stuff.
Very heavy
for not a payoff.
Be so glib about it.
Yeah.
They play very fast and loose with what you said, very heavy stuff. And like the early scene with Alicia Silverstone, it feels cheap. It feels like exploitation. And in a film like this, which is not traditional horror in the way that lots of people expect horror films to be, it relies more on dread and atmosphere to build its case. And it has plenty of that.
Yeah.
It has plenty of dread and plenty of atmosphere. But when you rely on that, you usually go down the road of psychological horror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where screenwriters invariably are not doing their homework, because mental illness and mental health trouble in cinema might be one of the last frontiers of absolute irresponsibility.
Oh, totally.
Where you just throw out a diagnosis of somebody or don't at all, like in this case, and expect everyone to be like, oh, well, this is about to get real crazy, you know? And you know what happens with those people. They start murdering everybody, you
exactly.
know? Like, it relies on your...
fear?
It relies on your fear of what it means to have mental health trouble. It relies on decades and decades and decades of accepted ways of showing mental illness in film. And those ways are not good, like almost ever. And so I am increasingly bothered by the rank stupidity of stuff like this, when it's clear that, you know, mental health is just a device to bring on mayhem, death, slaughter, terror.
Mm. And a thing that might not necessarily be this film's fault, depending on when it was made and all that kind of stuff, because this has been knocking around for a while. It premiered at Sundance 2018.
Oh, wow.
There is an ongoing thing involving a dollhouse and then certain angles of the real house that look like a dollhouse, where you're just thinking, like, this is like in Hereditary.
There's
this
no payoff.
This is the thing from Hereditary. Yeah, and it doesn't pay off either. But even just as a visual trope, it's like, this is right out of Hereditary. So, you know, whatever. Yeah, this is an annoying film. Much like Come to Daddy.
No, Come to Daddy is a little different.
Come to Daddy is not as annoying. It's just sort of, I think Come to Daddy, for me, would have been a great short.
Maybe.
But you can explain this one.
This is the first feature from a New Zealand director named Ant Timpson.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are Elijah Wood connections to New Zealand.
Oh, right, yes.
And also to genre horror filmmaking.
Yes.
Since Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. Elijah Wood has... It feels like a very conscious decision.
Oh, totally, yeah.
To step back from being a big celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's your neighbor.
Yeah. Yes, okay. He lives three doors down from me. I see him walking his dog and plugging in his car all the time.
And so,
he did that dog show. He's not even living in a big, whatever that was.
He doesn't even live in a big fancy place. It's like
he
is normalizing himself into the world as much as he can.
The floor space of his house might be smaller than the house I rent.
Right.
And he's far more interested in genre stuff than he is in sort of like career building kind of...
That's where I was going next. He could have taken the juice of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and moved into his 30s and 40s.
As a conventional
leading man. As a conventional, you know, maybe not leading man, but certainly... A reliable character actor his whole life. Because he was a child actor.
Oh, yeah.
And successful, very successful child actor from the time he was like eight or seven or just young, very young. And so I get this feeling from him from watching this career path that he's taken a detour down, that he is not interested in being, you know, a big, flashy name.
He's like, Nicolas Cage didn't have a whole lot of IRS debt. Like Nicolas Cage clearly wants to just make goofy genre movies, but like he obviously takes a lot of money roles because he's always owing.
Right. Elijah Wood's path feels very deliberate and very conscientious, and much more, honestly, more than Nicolas Cage's, much more... informed by the history of cinema.
Sure, yeah.
Because he has very decidedly gone down the path of genre horror and with a sort of nod to vintage stuff that is really gory, really creepy, really weird, often quite unsettling.
Yeah.
You know, he remade Maniac, which is...
A movie I couldn't finish watching for my Christmas book.
If you've ever seen the original Maniac, it will give you the creeps for the rest of your life. It's sleazy and gross, and therefore...
It feels like it was made one of the most effective horror films about a serial killer.
Yeah, therefore one of the most effective horror films I've, you know, seen.
Sure.
He produced The Greasy Strangler.
Yes.
If y'all have not seen The Greasy Strangler,
oh boy,
it's a trip. So he's gone down that road.
Yes.
And that's, I think, very cool. So this is the story of a man in his mid-30s who gets a letter from his father that he has not seen since he was five. And the letter says, please come see me. I want to see you. It's been decades, but I want to see you. Again, very remote location in the Pacific Northwest. This gorgeous house on a hill that overlooks the ocean. This beautiful view.
It does that horror movie thing of like, we got one location. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Right.
Blumhouse could have made this.
And when he arrives, a man opens the door and treats him very coldly and cruelly.
He's hostile.
The next couple days. He's very hostile. And
his dad.
And it's his father, maybe, but maybe it's someone else and we don't know.
Oh, okay.
And then terrible things happen.
Yes.
And I won't tell you what, because I like this a lot more than I liked The Lodge, for sure.
Yes, yes. It was not fair of me to really equate them.
Where am I trying to go with this? There is some intentional gross-out stuff in this movie.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, this is a really gory, violent splattery.
Yes, it is.
Point of impact, kind of nasty. Things really go down in this movie.
Yeah.
All right. Just warning you on that.
It doesn't have any of the cool reserve of the lodge. It's like right up in there.
Right. So there are elements of that that struck me as, oh, come on, that's just, you're being silly now. But then some other elements of that quality that made me think, oh, that's nasty. Let's see more. Like,
you have more of a taste of that kind of thing than I do.
No, I love that kind of thing. I love people getting their heads chopped off and body parts rolling around. And, you know, that's cool. I'm down. And that's one of the things I appreciate about the kinds of films Elijah Wood is working with now. It's not entirely successful as a film. It sets up some things that it doesn't deliver on later.
Sure.
I did lots of unanswered questions. You want to know more about some stuff.
Yeah. I liked the flashes of wit, though.
Yes.
Like the moments where, like, Elijah Wood is being kind of a pretentious douchey guy.
Yeah.
The scenes that he has with Martin Donovan, I think, are really funny.
Yes.
The clerk at the motel, I thought, was very funny.
Yes. Yeah.
It's funny. One thing I love about watching movies made in Canada is, like, it'll be some genre film, like, why do I know that person? Why do I know the person? And I realized, like, the woman who plays the prostitute in this film is radio psychologist Dr. Love in Hallmark's Murder, She Baked movies. Such things
Christmas
like
Murder Bakery.
That's right.
Yeah.
It is an okay movie. I think given the twist that it has, it would have been a great, like, 25-minute short film.
Sure. You might not be wrong. I liked it more than I didn't.
Okay.
It's more good than bad.
Yes, fair enough.
And I just appreciate, getting back to Elijah Wood, I appreciate him taking his perpetually Bambi-eyed face into middle age.
Yes.
And still working it that way.
The dinner plate
as
eyes.
As a counterpoint to whatever is going on around him.
Right.
Because the thing you always felt so strongly for him during the Lord of the Rings movie was this giant wide-eyed need to make everything turn out right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you loved him in those films for that reason. Like, you really were on his side. And now what he's doing is taking this physicality, this I'm a little guy and with giant eyes, and I'm 40. He's like 39.
39, yeah.
I'm nearly 40, but I still look like I could be 15. Like,
he looks young.
and he's doing that in the context of these truly disgusting set pieces of splattery horror. And I think his physicality is will always be, at least until he, I'd say, you know how Leonardo DiCaprio
one day was a man,
finally turned that corner and suddenly, oh yeah, now you're a grown man.
Yeah,
it might take Elijah Wood to 50 to get to that point, but until then, he's working the dissonance of his looks against the aesthetic of what he's doing.
I think the best thing about this movie is the way that it plays off of what we are expecting of male characters in this kind of movie.
Yeah.
So, like, in moments where somebody is, like, telling him, you have to do this thing.
Because that's what a man would do.
Because that's what a man would do. Yeah. And in other movies, of course they would do it. And he's like, what? You know, and like, I admire that because that would be me.
No, yeah. He really does not step up.
Yeah,
in the way that films want a traditionally masculine presence to step up,
right,
and his character just won't and doesn't,
yeah.
Which I also found cool.
I thought that was one of the more interesting aspects.
Like, we say this all the time. You know, if the Purge happens, what are you going to do? And my first thing is, well, I would just curl up in a ball and die.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's going to happen to me if the Purge actually happens.
I'm doomed.
You know, I may look like Shrek, but I'm a soft little cupcake. Like, this is not going down for me. I'm going to be the one who gets killed. And so the But the inclusion of that in this film was,
yeah,
you know, I was on board for that.
Then also this week we caught up on Gretel and Hansel.
Hansel.
Which is the new horror film from director Osgood Perkins, who I've been hearing great things about.
Hansel.
And I need to get caught up with his stuff because he did I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House and The Black Coat's Daughter, both of which got really good reviews from people who follow the horror genre. This movie is kind of it's an interesting retelling of Hansel and Gretel. The idea being that the witch doesn't necessarily want to devour both of them, but she definitely sees in Gretel like a potential...
My legacy.
Yeah. Like, oh, wow. Okay. Like kind of like wants to become her mentor in witchery, basically. And I kept thinking, is this about the conflict between second wave and third wave feminism? You know? And I might be reading too much into it, but I did like the idea of them not
fourth wave witchy feminism.
There you go. Like of them not necessarily just being victims, but of like her tapping into this sort of primeval, you know, feminine power that the witch extols.
Yeah,
you know, and
yeah, because with Hansel, the witch is like not caring so much about fattening him up, just sort of like just. Could you go somewhere else? Like, we've got business to take care of.
Your sister and I need to talk about the world. But the sister is played, Gretel is played by,
what are these people like?
Why do these
crazy
fly out
German
of my head?
Scandinavian names?
No. She's the girl from the It movies.
Oh.
Sophia Lillis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Who's terrific in this. And Alice Krieg plays the witch.
And wonderfully
she's so good. I love Alice Krieg as a character actress, you know, whether she's the Borg Queen.
Now I know who this is.
If you haven't seen Guy Madden's Twilight of the Ice Nymphs, check that out.
You should.
But yeah, she is enjoying the dialogue the way Gretel and Hansel are enjoying the food. You know, she is just getting every last delicious drop out of this whole thing.
And is the house a really like beautiful candy house?
No. They don't go that. It's this cool expressionist.
Yeah, it's very sort of like severe German looking.
Okay.
Black cabin in the woods, sort of like.
All right.
Like German expressionism. It's very stark and imposing.
It's the summer home of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah.
Our friend Alexi on Twitter said that the movie's all about the witch looks for spring, the soft pointed pink cap, and
the costumes,
the flowing bonnet, and the expressionist, you know, forest cottage.
The costumes are stunning.
Yeah.
The production design is really atmospheric and spooky and weird and dreamlike.
Oh, very much so.
If I had a complaint, it might not even be one, because I wrestled with this as I was watching the film. I thought, there's no big climax happening.
It doesn't have a traditional three-act structure.
No, it does. Yeah, it does not. It has moments that divert it down a new path. Moments where you think, okay, well, this is the setup for something else that's coming along. And it was, but it still kept this very sort of like muted quality to it. No highs and lows, really. Just increased weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where you learn how all the food gets made.
Goo! there has not been
I couldn't love more.
There has not been a greater gap between like the beauty of food and the horror of where it comes from since like The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Right.
there's a lot going on here. And I could see why, like, this is the kind of horror movie that makes horror fans on Twitter go, that was stupid.
Well, you know, a certain kind of horror fan that wants a
sensation,
really sensational payoff, that wants at least some kind of element of the slasher movies that they grew up with.
Yeah. They want some kills.
This is not that.
No.
This is
almost like a psychological drama.
This is horror the way Midsommar is a horror.
Yes, totally.
Now I gotta see it.
It is just weird and creepy, and it has a sort of gleefully diabolical point of view.
Yeah. And like Midsommar, I think it comes into that thing of like, what are you carrying around inside you, and who can tap into it in a way that is, you know,
both terrible and very helpful, actually.
Yeah, that is horrifying and potentially liberating.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's got that slowness, it sounds like, a little bit, that Midsommar has.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
It absolutely does.
It's not in a hurry to get to where it's going, but it's not long either.
And it has one of my favorite lines of dialogue so far in 2020 that I think I'm going to carry it with me throughout 2020, and that is when Hansel says, "It smells of cake! I can't resist!" That's my life motto.
I know. I turned. I was like, "That's you." And this is a lean 87 minutes. So
yeah. Oh wow.
By all means, yeah, people should check it out. And I think it is a movie that you will appreciate having seen in the theater because of how beautifully crafted it all is.
Yeah, I'm into it.
Yeah.
I didn't know that I would be, and it's getting mixed reviews.
Yes.
But I just
and I don't want to oversell it either. But I mean, I think it is. It does what it does very well.
Yeah.
You might not
be a good film, but there's so much great stuff in it.
Yeah.
That you, if this sounds like it's even remotely up your alley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to dig into the Perkins back catalog.
It ain't Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters or whatever the hell that was. That's not. Don't even think about that.
Okay,
one.
Good. Yeah. Phew. It is also not Who Slew Auntie Rue.
Well, yeah. That is true.
Very different.
Do we have
We have ad letter. We have time for one.
Ad letter. All right.
And I thought it was relevant to our discussion this week, so I didn't want to kick it to next time.
And that letter is about Margot Robbie. All right. Here we go. That was a very short letter from Dr. Steve. Okay. Yes. Hello, Dr. Steve.
Hello.
Friend of the show.
Indeed.
Friend in real life. With its February release, it's unlikely that Warner Brothers will push Birds of Prey for any Oscars, but in a fair and just world, should Margot Robbie receive as much attention for playing Harley Quinn as Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, and Joaquin Phoenix got for playing the Joker? Is her performance on that level?
I think she's doing something different. I think she's doing something that is mostly comedic, which the Academy tends to ignore no matter who it's coming from or in what context.
I think, if I may, Jack Nicholson threw himself into the cartoony aspects of the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
I think Heath Ledger's performance was operatic in its sort of scale. And I think Joaquin Phoenix's had more to do with sort of injurious physical pratfall comedy than pretty much anything other than that. And so...
And White Male Rage. Don't forget White Male Rage.
Sure, also that. But yeah, this is a different... Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn is a different kind of performance. It's much more comic and much more nervy. Very, like you said, Bugs Bunny-ish.
Yeah.
And clearly... time invested in the preparation for that role.
And Kyle Turner on Twitter made a point this week that you and I kind of disagreed about, where he said that like a woman playing a role like Joaquin Phoenix's Joker would not get the Oscar acclaim because they are more uncomfortable with, you know, a woman sort of like unhinged and violent than they are with a man. You cited Monster as an example of how they do welcome that kind of performance. But I think the difference there is that like the Joker gets away with it, and at the end of the movie is free. And Monster is about her being caught and punished and executed.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like how for a long time you got an Oscar for playing gay, but that character better be dead at the end of the movie. You know, your Tom Hanks and your William Hurts, and you know, I guess you're if we're LGBTQ, then I would include Hillary Swank.
Sure.
I think there's something to be said for like a character that is as genuinely disturbing as Phoenix's Joker sets out to be, played by a woman, is one that would wig out too many Oscar voters.
I think this topic actually goes back to, I read a book about the history of Catwoman, actually, and in that book they talk about how in classic noir films, the femme fatale often at the end of the film would die yes. because of her wicked ways. But because of the nature of comic books and not wanting to have to recreate a new villain every month, Catwoman would survive, or Poison Ivy would survive. And so it sort of inevitably cast these villainous females in a more positive light.
Because they had to keep reusing them.
Because they had just, for the, like, you know, it wasn't anything intentional, but they just had to keep reusing them. I mean, in a just world, I don't know, I'm sure there were, and nothing against Joaquin Phoenix's performance, but just the Joker film in general, I don't know if that warrants the kind of Academy attention that it's gotten. And then Jack Nicholson, I don't think he got a lot of...
He didn't get an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, but that is a great performance when he's in the destroying the art museum and listening to Prince. That's really fabulous.
Party man.
Yeah.
Johnny, we always love having you here. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at Top Notch Gamer. Gamer spelled with a Y between the A and the M. And you can find Super Gay at Super Gay Pod on Twitter. And also check out our most recent episode of Super Gay is about Harley Quinn and her relationship with Poison Ivy. She is a canonically queer character, though this film only hints at that in the very opening. So if you want to learn more about that relationship, which is a really fun one, listen to the new episode of Super Gay, which is also on the RSS feed for Linoleum Night.
It's true. We have posted that episode. So dig back a little and you'll find it. And again, we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife, and Johnny has one at patreon.com/supergays, G-A-Y-Z.
That's right.
Check out the extras and fun stuff that we offer exclusively to our subscribers. You may find it worth your while. So listen to our friends on the internet. Check out Bibbs and Whitney and all their shows on the Critically Acclaimed Network, the Schmoes Know podcast, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Sewers of Paris, Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Deck the Hallmark, a Big Fat Gay podcast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free on Apple Podcasts. Leave us that beautiful 5-star review and we will read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Spotify and Stitcher Radio and Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. And check out what he's up to at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next time with more. And until then,
goodbye.